Hello, this is Kathleen, and today, Wednesday, February 18th, I'll be reading to you from the Metro West Daily News. Chance for Chocolate. She may be but 22 months of age, but Alexandra Morganson of Wayland is apparently already aware that chocolate truffles are something special. The youngster was visiting chocolate therapy in Wayland Town Center on February 11th, a few days before Valentine's Day. Fire Official is Angry with the Select Board by Norman Miller. Northborough Deputy Fire Chief Neil Espacy said he feels disrespected and that his reputation is being besmirched after a Select Board member said Espacy and Fire Chief David Parente misled voters ahead of the town's 2024 approval of a new $41.3 million fire station. In a nearly three-hour, often emotional meeting with the Northborough Select Board, Espacy appeared with his attorney, Kate Fedoroff, on Monday, February 9th. They discussed allegations made during a previous meeting on January 12th that Espacy and Parente misled voters ahead of an October 2024 town meeting that represented the first of two steps toward approving construction of Northborough's first new fire station in 50 years. Parente, who has been out of work since January 13th due to a medical emergency, did not attend the February 9th meeting. Espacy said the allegations are an attack on his reputation and his character, and make him think he would not be considered for the chief's job in Northborough. Parente is scheduled to retire next month, or other communities. This is a direct impact on me, my family, my retirement, Espacy told the board. That's what I'm mad about, and I'm mad this board doesn't see that. During the January 12th Select Board meeting, Select Board member Jacob Jones presented a 26-page PowerPoint presentation about the building project at 61 to 65 West Main Street, Route 20, that he said shows the soil was contaminated, costing the town significantly more to remove than expected. Jones said it appeared information Parente and Espacy presented to the town meeting in October 2024 regarding the amount of contamination was false and misleading because they stated there was none. Fedoroff called Jones's PowerPoint presentation accusatory and said it was an assassination of these two gentlemen's characters. Jones, a former ZBA member who was appointed to a vacant seat on the five-member select board last May, had previously said he did not believe the chief or deputy intentionally misled anyone. But Fedoroff said the standard definition of mislead is to provide information to intentionally deceive. That is an attack. It is, she said. Fedoroff also said the presentation was inaccurate. She said Jones selectively chose information while glossing over other data. She also said much of the information that Jones used in the presentation was discovered after the town meeting vote. In addition, she said the numbers he used were incorrect. Jones said the town spent $1 million on soil removal due to contamination. But Fedoroff said it was less than $1 million and that $300,000 was budgeted, so it wasn't $1 million over budget. She said the rest was paid for by the built-in contingency money, noting that projects often run into unexpected issues. Fedoroff also argued the soil was not being removed due to contamination, but due to silt, which is unsuitable to build on. The silt makes the soil structurally unsound to build on, she said. It was the quality of the soil, not the petroleum or the contaminants. Jones argued the term misleading does not indicate any intention. He also said he would have preferred to handle the issue privately in executive session, and it was the chief and the deputy chief who wanted it handled publicly. He also read emails from May 2025 that repeatedly discussed the contaminated soil and read professional studies that said oil can cause unstable soil. I saw someone post the soil was not contaminated. It just smelled bad, Jones said. That's like saying my blanket got peed on by my cat. It smells like cat pee but doesn't have any cat pee on it. If it smells like petroleum, it's because it has petroleum in it. It is self-evident. Jones said he does not want to punish anyone, and he doesn't want any kind of litigation. Rather, he said, he wanted Parenti and Aspesi to take accountability for what he said was incorrect information provided to the voters. I was hoping to hear a little bit of contrition, because incorrect statements were made at town meeting, and it's not even acknowledged today that that was the case, Jones said. Firefighter Pat McManus, who is the head of the Northborough Firefighters Union, said the union supports Parenti and Aspesi. He said the select board's behavior will make it more difficult to find a new fire chief when Parenti retires. As a firefighter, it's frightening, he said. Resident Aaron Hutchins said Parenti and Aspesi should have made clear during the town meeting that the $300,000 budgeted to clean the soil had the potential to increase significantly, saying it may have changed some votes. Can you imagine the rancor or the debate if that was disclosed? He asked. After the public comment, Select Board member Michael Tietjen moved to dismiss the complaint against Aspesi, but did not get a second. The board instead voted to send the issue to Town Administrator Stephanie Bacon on the advice of its attorney, D.M. Moskus, because Bacon is the appointing authority for the deputy chief. Tietjen moved separately to dismiss the complaint against Parenti, for whom the board does have appointing authority. The board voted against it, saying it still wants to meet with him when he is able to attend a meeting. What residents expect to pay if gas prices go up next winter? By Margie Cullen from the USA Today Network, New England. Massachusetts residents' gas bills could increase by nearly 10% if a petition from the National Grid is approved. On January 16th, the National Grid filed a petition to increase its gas distribution rates so it can generate $342 million in additional revenue. The request comes as affordability is a major issue in the state, with energy prices being one of the main drivers. In November, 21% of Massachusetts voters said the utilities were the single biggest strain on their household budget in a Suffolk University Boston Globe poll. At the State of the Commonwealth in January, Governor Maury Healey announced that the state would temporarily lower electricity and gas bills in February and March. But if the National Grid's request is appointed by the State Department of Public Utilities, customers will see monthly bill increases in December. According to the National Grid and the Department of Public Utilities, a typical residential heating customer of the Boston Gas Company, which serves the greater Boston and central Massachusetts, will see their monthly bill increase by $23.66, or 8.4% during the winter season. A typical customer of the Colonial Gas Company, which serves some of the communities on the Cape and in Merrimack Valley, will see their monthly bill increase $24.76, or 9.4%. Slightly different rate increases will apply to low-income heating and non-heating customers and typical non-heating customers, as well as commercial and industrial customers. The DPU says the utilities can file petitions to recover reasonable and prudent costs that have been incurred to provide safe and reliable service to its customers and have the opportunity to earn a fair and reasonable rate of return on prudently invested capital. The National Grid is hoping to use the increase in revenue to pay costs, including for new gas pipes, to recover charges from billing errors last year, and to address gas safety regulations and compliance. According to DPU, if the petition is approved, customers can expect rate increases effective December 1st, 2026. Do I have a say? If you want to comment on the petition, you can submit emailed written comments to dpu.efiling@mass.gov. dpu2650.gridratecase@mass.gov and rhumm@keegan.weerlin.com by 5 p.m. on April 30th, 2026. There will also be 7 public hearings, March 18th in Lowell, March 23rd in North Quincy, March 26th in South Yarmouth, March 31st in Haverhill, April 6th in Lynn, April 9th in Acton, and April 15th in Boston. Black doll seen hanging from beads sparks outcry. Mardi Gras Group is investigating the incident, by Kate Perez from USA Today. A Mardi Gras social group said it was investigating an incident on a float during its February 14th parade in which a black doll appeared to hang by the neck from a necklace of beads. Videos appear to show the doll hanging by its neck from a strand of beads as it was held alongside other necklaces, waiting to be tossed into the crowd during the Crew of Tux parade. A young girl caught the doll attached to the beads at the parade, according to the social media post by the City of New Orleans. The Crew of Tux organization condemned the action following the parade, writing in a statement posted on social media that the behavior is intolerable and completely contrary to the beliefs and values the Crew of Tux holds. We intend to fully investigate this incident, and the responsible riders will no longer be permitted to have any association with the parade, the statement read. The leadership wishes this had been brought to our attention during the parade because it would have been addressed immediately. This was brought to our attention through social media, and we are immediately investigating. The organization added that it was offended by the behavior and would not tolerate it. Mardi Gras is a celebration of New Orleans and its diverse and rich culture, the statement read. We apologize for this racist display during our parade, and please know that this is not who we are, and we will address this swiftly. As of this reporting, Crew of Tux has not yet been publicly identified which float and members were responsible for the act. According to its website, Crew of Tux began in 1969 and is a 2,500-member parade organization with 50% men and 50% women. There is only one requirement for membership. You want to enjoy yourself, have a great time, and put on a magnificent show for the viewing crowd, the site reads. New Orleans Mayor Helena Moreno condemned the display in a statement on social media, calling it deeply offensive, unacceptable, and saying it has no place in our city. New Orleans is built on respect, diversity, and inclusion, and actions that seek to demean or intimidate any member of our community violate the very spirit of who we are, Moreno wrote. Our celebrations, particularly those where our children and families attend, should be in spaces of joy and unity, not exposure to hateful or harmful imagery, she continued in the caption of the post. Members of the New Orleans City Council echoed Moreno's sentiment. Council President J.P. Morrell issued his own statement on social media, saying he and the mayor had jointly reached out to Tuck's leadership to ensure the responsible party is held accountable. What is depicted isn't free speech. It is a disturbing effigy meant to harm and intimidate families and children, Morrell wrote. This isn't acceptable, and no one is above accountability. The carnival season culminated with Mardi Gras on February 17th. Civil rights icon Jackson dies at 84. Pushed for Black Voting Rights, Global Justice, by Trevor Hughes from USA Today. The Reverend Jesse Jackson, a towering civil rights icon who battled alongside the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., negotiated global hostage releases and shamed corporations for their lack of diversity and failure to support voting rights, died on February 17th. He was 84. Jackson was a Presidential Medal of Freedom recipient, a Democratic presidential candidate, and one of the world's best-known Black activists. It was with profound sadness that we announced the passing of civil rights leader and founder of Rainbow Push Coalition, the Honorable Reverend Jesse Lewis Jackson Sr., said a statement from the organization. He died peacefully on Tuesday morning, surrounded by his family. Jackson had progressive supranuclear palsy, a condition similar to Parkinson's disease. As we continue in the struggle for human rights, remember that God will see us through, even in our midnight moments, he said in 2017 as he announced his diagnosis. His longevity is part of the story, said Rashad Robinson, the former president of the 7-million-member online justice organization Color of Change. This is someone who had so many changes to do with something else, and this is what he chose to do with his life. Jackson's death came amid a rising tide of white nationalism and voting rights access issues, and follows the loss of other civil rights icons, including Georgia Representative John Lewis, who died in 2020. In a lengthy statement, President Donald Trump said he had known Jackson for many years and described the civil rights leader as a good man and a force of nature. He noted that he had provided office space for Jackson and his Rainbow Coalition in Lower Manhattan. The Reverend Bernice King, the daughter of Martin Luther King Jr., said Jackson devoted his life to lifting people in poverty, the marginalized, and those pushed to society's edges. He was a gifted negotiator and a courageous bridge builder, serving humanity by bringing calm into tense rooms and creating pathways where none existed, she wrote on X. The Reverend Al Sharpton, the civil rights and social justice activist, praised the life of his mentor. He was a consequential and transformative leader who changed this nation and the world. He shaped public policy and changed laws, he wrote on X. He kept the dream alive and taught young people from broken homes, like me, that we don't have broken spirits. Born in Greenville, South Carolina, to a teen mother and her married neighbor in 1941, Jackson was adopted by the man his mother married. He considered both men to be his fathers. He attended a segregated high school and played football in college. His rise to prominence began after he and seven other men were arrested in 1960. He was 18 at the time, for protesting segregation at their town's public library. By 1965, he'd marched in Alabama with Martin Luther King Jr., from Selma to Montgomery, to push for black voting rights. He dropped out a few credits short of his master's degree in divinity in 1966 to join the civil rights movement full-time. By 1967, he was running operations for King's Southern Christian Leadership Conference in Chicago, the city that became his home. Under Jackson, the SCLC's Operation Breadbasket used boycotts and public attention to pressure companies to hire more black workers. He was just feet away when King was assassinated in 1968. Jackson ultimately earned his divinity degree after being ordained a minister that same year. Jackson went on to found what would become the Rainbow Push Coalition and ran for president as a Democrat in 1984 and 1988, energizing and registering millions of black voters. In 1983, shortly before announcing his run for president, Jackson traveled to Syria to negotiate the release of an American pilot shot down over Lebanon. The next summer, he negotiated the release of 22 Americans and 26 political prisoners from Cuba. His success bolstered his presidential campaign, although he lost the 1984 Democratic primary to Walter Mondale. Jackson ran again for president in 1988, putting on a strong showing but ultimately failing to Michael Dukakis. After that second loss, Jackson shelved his political aspirations but continued his efforts for civil rights and justice. In 1990, Jackson opposed the pending invasion of Iraq and negotiated the release of hundreds of people whom the Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein had threatened to use as human shields. In 1999, he won the release of three U.S. prisoners of war during the Kosovo War. In 2000, President Bill Clinton awarded Jackson the Presidential Medal of Freedom, citing his decades of work to make the world a better place. It's hard to imagine how we could have come as far as we have without the creative power, the keen intellect, the loving heart, and the relentless passion of Jesse Lewis Jackson, Clinton said. His activism remained tireless and unstoppable, despite the illness that softened his voice and weakened his steps. Jackson visited Minneapolis in 2021 to support protesters awaiting the verdict in the trial of Derek Chauvin, the former police officer who was convicted of killing George Floyd. While there, he attended services for Dante Wright, a black man who was shot and killed by a police officer during a protest against police violence. Speaking in a subdued voice, Jackson reminded the young activists that their cause was just. He was arrested twice that year over his objection to Senate filibuster rule. Traherne Cruz, who helped found the Black Lives Matter Minnesota chapter, said he grew up with Jackson's "I Am Somebody" recitations ringing in his ears. Jackson often led crowds in a call and response chant that included variations on, "I may be poor, but I am somebody. I may be young, but I am somebody." That allowed future generations to stand up and follow in his footsteps, Cruz said. That activists encouraged activists of today to stand up and fight against 400 years of racist policies in the United States. Robinson, the former president of Color of Change, remembers family members making their first political donations after listening to one of Jackson's presidential campaign speeches. "I didn't understand everything he said, but I understood what it meant," said Robinson. "He was such a possibility model. There are so many people who are in politics today who would not be where they are today, thanks to Jesse Jackson. There certainly would be no Barack Obama if there was no Jesse Jackson, and there would have been no Bill Clinton either." Driverless trucks to begin nonstop routes, some operating with humans on board, by Karina Vanek from the Arizona Republic and USA Today Network. Aurora Innovation, an autonomous commercial trucking company, is beginning routes to Phoenix from Fort Worth, Texas. The line stretches more than 1,000 miles across three states and takes about 15 hours to complete. The nonstop route exceeds the legal hours of service standards for human drivers set by the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration. Human drivers can drive a maximum of 11 hours according to the rules set by the administration. The extension to Phoenix comes with the company's latest software launch and triples the size of Aurora's driverless network. The launch also now allows trucks to operate in inclement weather like rain, fog, and heavy wind. According to the American Trucking Association's 1.1 million new truck drivers will be needed over the next decade to meet freight demand. Expanding across the Sun Belt and introducing customer endpoints enables us to provide our customers with the capacity they need to move goods at a scale that wasn't possible before, Chris Urmson, co-founder and CEO of Aurora, said in a statement. "Being a carrier is a game of margins, and if autonomy can work around the clock, it will be the key to growing our customers' business." Aurora plans to expand driverless operations into Nevada and most of the southeastern United States, the company announced in its fourth quarter earnings results. Customers of Aurora include Hirschbach Motor Lines, which used Aurora's supervised driverless vehicles to distribute Driscoll's Berries, and Detmar Logistics, which used Aurora to deliver sand from a sand pit. In December, the company expanded its driverless operations to 10 trucks, but by the end of 2026 expects to have about 200 driverless trucks on the road, Urmson wrote in a letter to shareholders. Some of its trucks are operating with onboard humans monitoring safety. The company's full commercial truck capacity is committed through the third quarter of 2026. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you all have a safe and well day.